Dr. Rock's radio show. Every Thursday night at 9 on raconteursnews.com. We go to 11.
Well, good evening and a very warm welcome to Dr. Rock's radio show here on raconteursnews.com. And tonight we're coming to you live from the flatlands of Norfolk. We're just outside King's Lynn this time in a completely different field with completely different people from the ones we were with last week, which is fantastic. So another great weekend coming up. There'll be tonight's show, probably another show on Saturday night as well. We kicked off there with Big D and the Kids Table, who I'm still exploring. We all have something to burn. We all have to burn something. That's what it's called. I think that's good, isn't it? It's all about letting go. They were followed by Slap Your Mama Big Band and A Little Rub, and we could all do with a little rub every now and then. And then the Stranglers, because we all know that something better change. Well, tonight, got a couple of guests lined up for you. The first one, a lady called Sarah. We all know that you love to hear Synchro talking about her walking, and most of you will remember that she did a walk a long time ago, a 500-odd mile walk called Awakening Albion, where they travelled all the way from Cornwall to Hopton, somewhere not too far from where we are at the moment, actually, following all the way from the Beltane sunrise up to the summer solstice, I think it was. And Sarah was one of the people that did some of that walk with Jess, which is how come she's come to graciously agree to come on the Dr. Rock radio show. So thanks very much, Sarah, for joining us.
You're welcome. Lovely to be here.
And you've got a very exciting project going on. I've been just having my first look at your website, and what a thing to be taking on, the Orchard Barn project. I mean, were you doing that when you went on the walk, or how did those two things mesh together at all for you?
I'd just started the Orchard Barn project when I was doing the walk, and there was something about walking from Glastonbury up to East Anglia and opening up the channels that were enabling something amazing to be happening in East Anglia. So just beginning in 2008.
Yeah. And did you find that the walk was in any way helpful to the starting of such? Because, I mean, it's a major mission you've taken on there.
It is a major mission. I don't think I knew how major a mission it was at the beginning. Fortunately.
So hi there, Nick, come on in. So we've got Nick Collerstrom coming on a little bit later on. So what did you start with? You've a bit of land and some buildings. What did you have?
Okay, so to begin with, it was a derelict barn, 17th century barn in 1.5 acres of even more derelict orchard, so no maintenance, nothing for decades, and it somehow called me to get involved with it. That was possibly the easiest bit. Since then, we have done some amazing things. We set up a community interest company, which now delivers traditional and natural building courses. But we've done the restoration as a series of courses. So we've worked with volunteers and trainees to bring this 17th century barn back and give it a new lease of life as a rural skills centre.
And why did you choose the public interest company particularly as a way of incorporating this project?
Community interest companies were quite new when we started in 2007, and we didn't want to be a charity, and we felt that being a community interest company would enable us to involve community. It would also enable us to run courses that were environmental, that had social benefits, and so it felt like it was a much bigger picture than a smaller charity route.
So what are the distinguishing features of the of that particular structure that made you choose it? What was the most beneficial feature? Because obviously we've got cooperatives, and I mean, I can quite understand not wanting to become a charity. But what basically is it that defines the form that you chose? Do you know? No?
It was a fairly unknown structure at the time. So we were going with a gut instinct that it was the right thing to be doing, and it certainly has been. We've got a list of objectives, we review them every year, we're responsible to Companies House, there's a CIC regulator, we've got a fantastic management team and members who have who come and vouch for, well, they're mostly volunteers who are involved, who come and vouch for the fact that we're doing what we set out to do. So that's some of the benefits of being a CIC.
So have you found that your volunteers have come back sort of several times and then eventually ended up getting more permanently involved in the project, or are they all transients?
We have a lovely group of committed local people now. It hasn't always been the case. We've worked with people from all over East Anglia, all over the UK, and to some extent all over the world, have sought us out and come and worked and helped us develop. But at some point, we needed to be more based in the really local community. So my house, which used to be a place where people would come and stay and help and get involved, I had to actually make a conscious decision that I wanted for it to be more local people. And so I stopped being a help ex and a woof host. And as I made that decision, lots of local people stepped forward and continue to come on a weekly basis, sometimes two or three times a week. And it's definitely growing. It's brilliant.
It's funny how when you decide to change your approach, the whole game plan changes around you, isn't it? It's almost as if what you're kind of wanting to do is then expressed in the environment around you. I think that's really quite a magical story. So, but to start with, there was just you, was there? And you were stepping into this and trying to draw.
I'm the co-founder of the CIC. I founded it with a very good friend of mine, Peter Jane Gulliver, who's actually a shamanic healer. So together we founded the CIC. But prior to that, I had seen the barn. I was teaching yoga at the time. I wanted to expand my yoga business into a venue that was pretty much adjacent to the parish where I live. I'd managed to remortgage my house in order to be able to buy the barn with a view to it becoming a yoga centre. But now it is so much more than the yoga centre. It's yoga in its truest form, which is environmental education and people literally learning how to work with the earth in positive ways.
So it's not actually a dwelling. You've got a land, you've got a patch of, how big's the patch of land?
It's an acre and a half of old orchard. We've got some really old trees there, and part of it's still a wildlife zone, part of it we still haven't actually found.
And are the trees still productive?
The trees are more productive than they have ever been, and the land itself is regenerating in a way that I could never have imagined. We clear a patch, brambles basically, we clear the brambles, and up out of that land pops elm and cherry plum and greengage, and they fill that space in an abundant way. I've never seen anything quite like it.
And are you seeing, because I'm aware that as things get restored like this, you get to see your wildlife and things returning. Have you seen any of that happening around the place?
That's a very good question. Yes, we've also got a huge, huge pond, probably more of a moat. In fact, it's where they harvested the clay for some of the clay lump buildings in the area. So 2 years ago, we were able to take out 550 tons of silt from it and clean up the water. And since then, we've seen newts swimming in there, and the dragonflies are coming back, and we've got frogs. It's excellent.
And what, may we ask, did you do with the 550 tons of silt?
It was very carefully timed for immediately after harvest, and the farmer across the road very kindly agreed to us tipping it on his field. And I have to say, it grows the best crop there. There was the understanding that we would walk and wade our way through that silt and pull out anything that he didn't want to plough in. So we did 2 days of bog walking.
And was there a lot of stuff in there that he didn't want in his field?
No unusual treasures, but what we did find was what we came to call bog elm, because there'd been this big elm tree that had fallen over and had been sitting in the pond possibly for decades. It was black, but it was the most amazing shapes. And so we pulled all of that out, and we pulled out floor bricks and other bits of timber frame from the old house that is also on that site.
And is the bog elm useful for anything?
The bog elm is going to be used for sculptures. Right. Yes, I have some shelves in the old orchard waiting for us to move into the next phase, because a lot of what we've done is building, but we're moving into more of a rural craft sculpture phase. And so the bog elm, going to use that for that.
Must be rock hard, I would have thought. So, well, that's brilliant. And when it came to the building, how much of the barn was left when you started? Did you have to take it all apart, or where did you go with that?
Well, it was difficult to see what there was. The thing was so overgrown with brambles. It was sort of 18, 20 foot tall in brambles. Getting to it was a major expedition with scythes and loppers. But underneath all the brambles and what we came to call structural ivy, because it was in fact holding some of the building together structurally, we discovered that there was... The frame itself was in, well, two-thirds of it was in relatively good shape. We did some timber frame repair courses to bring it back into good order. So it looked worse with all that overgrown ivy on it than it actually was.
So it was a timber frame, and it was presumably infilled with something. Was it stone or cob, or what was the rest of the structure made of originally? How was it originally built?
Okay, so it's late 17th century, and we found some evidence of old laths or laths on the back, and a little bit of what I think is probably a daub, and I think probably that had a clay render over the top of it. Certainly in part of the lean-to roof at the back, we found wattle and daub underneath the roof tiles, and we've gone on to replicate that. In fact, wattle and daub is pretty much our signature, if you like.
Okay, and are you harvesting the all of the materials from the land, or are you having to import any of it?
Well, a moment ago I mentioned that they harvested a huge amount of subsoil from the pond, so we've followed suit. In fact, we're learning from the past how to build a greener future, and we're encouraging people to think about what's under their feet. We are harvesting our clay from a ditch at the back of the barn, so we're improving our drainage as well as harvesting this amazing building material. The trees, we can use some of our small dimension elm trees, and we have, to make roof rafters. But when we want something a bit bigger than that, say green oak for a sole plate or a wall plate, we've started working with a local woodsman. As volunteers, we go and help him with the restoration of his woods, and in exchange he gives us the timber, so it's a win-win situation. That's about 10 miles down the road, so it's relatively local.
I think that's one of the most exciting things about your project, as far as I'm concerned, is the way it's drawing a local community together, and the way it sounds like you're starting to... it's not just a matter of keeping old skills alive, but it's a matter of actually bartering the one thing for another, so you're presumably becoming a bit more resilient as a result of that.
I think not having lots of money has been our strength. We have had to find ways of making it work. And historically, buildings have come from the land, and I firmly believe that they could come from the land again. And that's what we're doing here at Harlequin, is working with children to sow those seeds about, look, this is actually subsoil, and these are sticks, and we can potentially make small buildings out of them. In terms of resilience, we are intentionally off-grid. So we harvest our own water off the roof. We use hand tools, so we don't need mains electricity. And we have water-free compost toilets, which I delight in inviting contributions to.
Yes, indeed. A deposit for the future. So the barn's done now and usable, is it? The walls and roof. What's it got on the roof? Has it got a slate roof or shingles? Or
the roof was another leap of faith. We decided to replace a very shallow pitch tin roof, which had been the barn's saving grace because it kept a lot of the water out. And the barn's roof would have been originally thatch, so it would have been a much deeper pitch. We decided, and by this stage we'd been offered trees from the local woods, and we went and chose them. And ran some courses in how to build a traditional pitch roof. And then, so that was the easy bit, that took 2 months. And then we started making our own oak shingles. So 20,000 of them. Say it quickly, but it was quite a big learning curve. We birthed a roof. It took us 9 months.
20,000 oak shingles. I can't even begin to imagine what that must be like. It sounds, it must be quite a big building. What sort of footprints has it got, and what are you, what kind of uses are you putting it to? 20,000 oak shingles.
I want to put the 20,000 shingles into perspective. They were the work of 70 people over that period of time. So that's 70 people who now know they can make a roof from trees. The footprint of the barn, it's about 40 foot by 18. It's got a beaten earth floor either side of an old threshing floor. And we use it as a workshop. So we run timber framing courses in it. And we're in the process of running a series of courses to put up our new craft room actually in it. So that's what we use it for.
What sort of craft people do you have interested in using the space? Because I think you've got a fair spectrum of them by now, haven't you?
At this moment in time, a lot of green wood work, making best use of local wood and making best use of local clay. I think it will certainly expand from that, but that's where we're, what we're looking at the moment.
And what's the land being used for? Is it being used to grow more building materials, or are you thinking of doing veg, or what's going on? Because acre and a half, I bet a lady like you could make a lot of use of that.
I am an ex-organic smallholder, so yes. But we're growing vegetables. That's Steve's baby. He works mostly, we do volunteer work with gardening on a Tuesday. And he's developing a series of raised beds in the huggle culture style. So huggle culture makes best use of our small dimension sticks, of which we've still got a rather a lot. And it's, they're growing some great vegetables.
And do you have any kind of, do you cater for the courses that come there? Do you have a kind of kitchen that does that, or how's that handled?
So when people come these days, we invite them to bring a packed lunch and a flask. There may be some point in the future where we can cater for people again, and certainly Justine, who's sitting to my left, has cooked many a supper for people in the early days, but as things stand at the moment, we haven't got that level of catering possibility. Hopefully we will.
Was that an official decision that made it difficult for you to do that?
No official decision, no, just a decision to stay out of health and safety's way.
Fair enough, yeah. It's sometimes easier to avoid having those decisions being made. Well, that all sounds really interesting. Do you hope in the long run that there will be somebody able to dwell there, or do you think it will always be a kind of arm's length thing from home?
That's a very good and very timely question, because we are moving into phase three. So phase one was the barn, phase two are the craft rooms, and phase three is the restoration of a 1580s Suffolk longhouse, which at the moment is a pile of sticks on the ground, but with some amazing timbers that I know are entirely repairable, and potentially that's a caretaker's accommodation and more internal accommodation for people to come and stay in, but possibly a kitchen. So that could be where we're able to help provide lunches for people using our own produce, of course.
Yeah. Always nice to be able to use your own produce. Well, that sounds like a really exciting project. I mean, are we going to see that whilst we're here, are we? Or we don't know. Because the thing is, folks, that we're going to be hanging around for a couple of days after the Harlequin, because we've got a lot of friends over in the east of England, so we're going to be going and seeing one or two people, because it sounds lovely. I really like the look of the website. It's really nice to see it. But thank you very much, Sarah. That was great. Thanks for joining us, and best of luck with all of that.
Thank you. Absolutely brilliant to be able to tell the story a bit wider. Thank you for inviting me.
That's great. I hope people enjoy the website. Yeah, it does, doesn't it? It's the website's really pretty too. Just Jimmy's put in the chat box, he's put, who is the Doc's guest? She should be a full-time radio host with a voice like that. And then he's put in, Synchro's now got real competition. We know Jimmy really loves Synchro's voice, but that's all right, because we also know that Synchro really loves Jimmy's voice. So very much a bit of a mutual admiration society. So we're going to give ourselves 7 or 8 minutes of music or so before we get to talk to Dr. Nick Collerstrom, and we're going to be tonight talking about 9/11 and Star Wars, that's it. 9/11 and Star Wars. Is that a modern parable? And perhaps we'll probably be getting into the other Paul McCartney as well, which is something I wanted to talk to him about when we were at the Harlequin last year. But we were too busy talking about whether man actually went to the moon or not. So here we go. Here's Memory War from the Asian Dub Foundation. And we'll be back with you in 8 minutes or so, folks. RaconteursNews.com, Dr. Rock's radio show, out of the field. There we go. That was Opaque. And they chose to lead us, apparently, and apparently we chose them to lead us as well. Strange, that, isn't it? I'm told it really is happening, though. Anyway, thanks very much to Sarah for joining us. She's now gone off to grab a bit of kip. And I'm now joined by Dr. Nick Collistrom. Thanks very much for coming back, Nick.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back here again, Dr. Rock.
That's really great to be sharing the same field again. I was really pleased to see your name on the schedule. And you're doing a new thing. You are. You're doing Star Wars and 9/11 and a modern parable. What drew your interest to that then?
Yeah, well, I have done this before with Jim Petzer in America as a dialogue, but I feel I want to try and develop a bit. You see, I was in the 9/11 Truth Group for many years. We're trying to campaign the meaning of it. What significance does it have? This is a big key event at the dawn of this new millennium. And basically, we never got through to people. We didn't feel we had. And it seems to me this tremendous drama of Star Wars by George Lucas is a modern parable that gives us a way of thinking and talking about it. You see, most people miss out the so-called prequel of the Star Wars, the first three. You know, you come in with Darth Vader and it's all a big mythic type of drama. And then the first three were made last. He made the first three, and if you say the last three, everyone knows, are mythic. The first three are more political, and they were made over the time of 9/11, the transition between one millennium and the next, okay? And the third of these is when, as it were, the great darkness comes into the world. The Jedi all get wiped out, and Darth Vader gets created. And that comes out just after 9/11.
So let me just get this clear. Those are the very first three Star Wars movies that I remember when I was a youngster. The ones you're talking about there. I go a bit, because of course they're made in a bit of a strange order.
Probably not, right? You got it the wrong way around. The first three you remember as a youngster are what's called episodes 4, 5, and 6.
Okay.
Now, he then made the first three later on.
Right.
And he'd got much more enhanced powers of making sort of digital reality and imaginary creatures.
And were they, I haven't seen them, I must admit, those three, that were they. Were they cracking movies? Because I know they took a bit of a kicking at the credit with the critics, didn't they?
Oh, shucks, but if you haven't seen them, a lot of people didn't get what they were about and slagged them off. Like, it's about the appearance of the clone army. The first one is called The Phantom Menace, which I feel is a terribly important concept. With 9/11, we're given a bogus enemy image, right? You're given these 19 Muslim hijackers as the enemy, and the new kind of war of civilization defined. We're always getting fiendish Muslims did that. And I'm always showing how, with these events, actually the Muslims weren't doing it. Actually, this is state-fabricated terror. Actually, the story you're given is an illusion. Actually, this whole new century political momentum is based on a phantom menace concept of a image of Islamic terrorists. The 19 Muslims did not do 9/11. I feel that this George Lucas concept of the phantom menace is a really good way of approaching this.
Well, I think you're almost certainly right, and I will give these. I know people who've got these movies, so I will be giving them a look on your recommendation. But I'm aware that for the for episodes 4, 5, and 6, otherwise known in my mind as 1, 2, and 3, that George Lucas is actually a great fan of what's the man's name? Synchro, our famous mythmeister, Joseph Campbell, and I know Joseph Campbell spoke pretty highly of Joe Lucas, so he's obviously got a good grounding in his subject.
Yeah, Joseph Campbell, the great American mythologist. I think it's terribly important that George Lucas and Campbell got together and discussed these matters. For example, Darth Vader is the Dark Father. Okay, he's the distant dark father that everybody's kind of scared of, and he's got this terrific power. And maybe in America, you say a generation grew up whose fathers had gone off to Vietnam and they never really saw their fathers, never knew their fathers. And so this Darth Vader image has a terrific resonance with them. And Joseph Campbell, he talked about the hero's journey, and Lucas was consciously trying to create that. Mm. I think that is that was certainly important for him. On Lucas Valley, in his Skywalker Ranch in Lucas Valley, he developed his wonderful California dreams. See, as a kid, he was inspired by Flash Gordon. And so he made this tremendous sequence of galactic warfare in six films, I'm going to argue that these first three have a real political relevance for us mm-hmm. today.
Well, it completely passed me by that these came around about the same time as 9/11, and the Phantom Menace thing I think is a strong enough argument for going and giving them a look anyway. What else was in that first film, and where did he go next?
Yeah, well, let me try and summarise it for you. Yeah. The first three are about how democracy is extinguished by a total autocratic power, which comes in, and how does it come in? How does the Senate vote to give this autocratic power to one particular individual, who then proclaims, he says, "I proclaim this first galactic empire." So you've got an empire which is totally autocratic. And the first three episodes are the process. Why does a democracy deliberately give up its power into an absolute autocracy? And the bit we all know, the films you've seen, you've got, that is already established. You've got Darth Vader, and you've got a dualistic universe with the Jedi who are fighting against Darth Vader, and he's actually what's called the Sith Lords in George Lucas. They are opposing the Jedi, so there's a kind of cosmic struggle goes on between those who are those the Jedi defending, which is supposed to be, you know, democracy, and the Sith, who are more powerful. Sith are actually more powerful than Jedi. And how can that possibly be? Well, maybe it's because they believe in the quest for absolute power. They say, use your anger that this young lad Anakin, who grows up in the first three episodes, use your anger, you know, use your desire for total power, go with it. Whereas the Jedi have to renounce that quest for absolute power.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, are two sides of the same coin. That's interesting, that, because that was, I remember, in 1984... the fundamental difference between the party they had in ruling there and the ones they'd had before was that this one was willing to admit that it was only ruling for the sake of power and was not actually acting for the benefit of anybody else. Is that, do you think...
Oh, right, the novel, 1984. Yeah, I got you. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, there are some similarities. Let's go on to the occult theme, which I think nearly everybody misses. I'm fairly sure 99% of people listening to this didn't get this, that you've got this Senator Palpatine, who's a benevolent-looking chap. He's on the Senate of this galactic federation, okay? The Federation. He's actually a Sith Lord. And he's got this occult power. And he can project a double... so far away to a different distant planet, and that double is named what's his name? Sidious, Darth Sidious, and the double can give commands to this rebel army, and can actually produce another Sith Lord, and they set about this whole, there's a quarantine of a planet and a whole complicated drama, which leads to the wars, terrific wars with drones and clones involved in this terrific war that George Lucas imagines, okay? So the conflict is stirred up, get this, the terrific wars we see in episodes 2 and 3 are stirred up simply so that Palpatine can gain absolute power, okay? I'll just say that again if I may. The wars that are stirred up in these first initial episodes of Star Wars are not in themselves necessary. They are, if you like, kind of false flag wars in the sense that they are generated by the senator who projects this mysterious occult double and can create can lead a rebel army into a war, and that crisis of a war going on leads the Senate, who don't realise what's going on, to renounce their democratic powers and give absolute power to this one fella who, unknown to them, is actually the cause of it all.
Which, of course, is actually pretty much what happened on 9/11, as far as we can tell.
Well, there you go. This is the sort of deep analogy. What the hell was 9/11? Who did it? Who the hell did it? And how did they do it? Well, I mean, if you want a very brief summary, basically it's a mystery. Let's remember that. How did many hundreds and thousands of tons of building turn into fine white powdery dust in 10 seconds? Whoever managed to do that, do they not control the world that we live in now? And that is a mystery, okay? Anyone who thinks they understand how that happened is kidding themselves. If pressed, you know, we all say 9/11 was an inside job. Yeah, it was an inside job, but also it was elements of the neocons in America but a massive Israeli input and planning as well. It was Zionist neocon job somehow. That's about as far as we can get, but it's still very mysterious. There's absolutely no one who admit that they did it or that they had a part in this. The most decisive visual image ever seen by the human race, you know.
But it has served really to, as I guess was probably hoped, to turn the American people, if you like, into a kind of a surrogate army and to continue crusades that we started a long time ago. There's such an unlikely connection to have made, really, from that particular...
Yeah, it started some crusade. It was intended to try and get a new war of civilization going to be able to project the American Empire, okay? After communism died out in 1991, it was a very acute problem. What were hundreds of American bases doing all around the world? You couldn't have the old excuse anymore. And 9/11 gave a new founding myth for the new millennium and the empire. In a way, you could say from the neocons' point of view, the reason they did this, they've now got the largest empire the world has ever seen, larger than that of ancient Rome, which sort of goes all around planet Earth, and they've got an army far more powerful than anyone else's, whether or not it's stable. So there is a kind of empire, and I'm saying that the artistry of George Lucas, intuitively, maybe not very rationally, but intuitively, he's given us a myth of our time which parallels and helps us to get a handle on what is going on here.
I would have thought to a certain extent, especially given the Joe Campbell link, that what Lucas is exploring is archetypes, and they're probably the same archetypes that are being explored and exploited by the people who pulled off 9/11.
Yeah, deep stuff. Well, maybe. But let me just throw this one in. A lot of people, science say, when asked what the religion is, they say a Jedi, okay? And apparently around the beginning of the century, that was when it peaked, the number of people who said their religion was Jedi, and it was the fourth most popular religion in this country, apparently. And why do people like it? Well, the Force, let the Force be with you, the Force, work through the Force and so on, is a kind of non-transcendental deity principle. It's some moving thing, that force that goes through the universe, and the Jedi. The great appeal of the Jedi is, unlike the religions we've got now, there's a warrior spirit to it. The strength you get from the Force is actually skill in using the lightsaber. So it isn't just a sort of the Force has this. It is defined practically rather like the medieval knights. You know, the medieval knights, the virtue of Sir Lancelot or whatever, was in that his strength and skill in combat.
Yeah.
And his strength and skill in combat showed his virtue, didn't it?
Yeah.
And you don't get that now. If somebody's a cowboy is quick on the draw, that doesn't show virtue, it just shows he's faster. So George Lucas has brought in this idea of the lightsaber, this idea that some sort of virtue which the Jedi has, which... when they can say, you know, my knowledge of the Force is such that I can defeat you. So that sort of dialogue that goes on, you know. So he's brought in something which is kind of religion. It's got elements of Eastern religion, but it's also got this what I think is slightly medieval knightly ethos of combat, that the Jedi is sworn to protect. Now we could do a bit more detail from George Lucas what exactly the Jedi are sworn to protect, but broadly speaking, it's the democracy of the Galactic Federation.
Yeah, I mean, once I heard about the connection between Lucas and Campbell, which I saw in some of the documentaries that made about Campbell in the last couple of years of his life, what struck me about Use the Force, Luke, and all of that was I remembered one of Campbell's repeated and one of his most strong messages. He said, when students come to me and they ask for advice, I suggest to them that they follow their heart, that they follow their bliss, because when they do that, doors will open for them that wouldn't have opened otherwise. In fact, doors will open for them that aren't even there for other people. And in my mind, when I heard about the Lucas-Campbell connection, that's what I connected Using the Force with, was this idea that you follow your bliss and you follow your heart. I know they put it across in the films as a martial thing, but do you think there might be something? I know that's a bit of a left-field question.
Yeah. Well, the ancient Persian religion was of cosmic duality, a battle between light and darkness, and that was irresolvable. It was the fabric of the universe. This conflict was going on. Now, it opens with the Jedi having, as far as they knew, the Sith had been banished for 1,000 years. If I may say so, George Lucas's back history is a bit shaky and vague, and we could do with it being defined a bit more, you know. But the Sith had been gone for 1,000 years, and they simply don't believe it. When they first hear that the Sith have come back, somebody, Count Dooku, tries to warn them, look, the Sith have come back, and they finally dawns on them when... is it Qui-Gon, the elderly first Jedi, finds himself in combat with this fellow and wondering who it is. Is it a Sith Lord? Have the Sith come back again? So this is an ancient duality, like sort of cat and mouse. They're defined as being opposite, and nowhere in his films does George Lucas give us a point of reconciliation, okay? And that's totally different, I must suggest, to Joseph Campbell, who is not a dualistic philosopher. Joseph Campbell is in, as you say, follow your bliss, mm-hmm. let your heart tell you what to do, and how religion help us to fulfil our lives,
yeah.
Right? And that doesn't involve this dualistic... that is, as it were, let's put it this way, it's not so exciting as George Lucas. Once you have a dualistic philosophy, it's all terrifically exciting because, you know, there's going to be big battles and everything.
I mean, to a certain extent, if you're going to do the sci-fi blockbuster, you have absolutely no choice but to adopt the dualistic philosophy, I would have thought. Maybe somebody could do a Follow Your Bliss sci-fi...
Yeah, but how long can you go on with these cosmic battles with people being interested? I mean, the first episode... has a Death Star being blown up, okay?
Yeah.
The little Anakin, who's amazingly talented, gets into a spaceship and kind of by mistake goes out and blows the whole damn thing up. He's the little kid. And then episode 4, as we all know, has a Death Star being blown up. Well, surely twice is enough. But George Lucas then sold the franchise. Well, God knows why, but he sold it to this Jewish producer... You know, he's made episode 7 now, and that had yet another Death Star being built and blown up. So it's getting corny and silly. I regret that George Lucas did allow it to be sold on, and you know, gave a 7-figure sum payment to Harrison Ford just for turning up again as Han Solo. I mean, I think that's not art. I think that's a betrayal of his.
So is that what happened with the most recent one, whatever episode number it is? Because that one I did actually go and see at the cinema, and I didn't enjoy it as much as the first ones.
No, it's a load of crap. it didn't have any plot really at all.
No, thank you.
It didn't have any plot, and it just had a committee just deciding. Oh yeah, well, we like the bit where Darth Vader had a battle with his son Luke Skywalker. We like that bit, so let's do that again, shall we?
Yeah.
So we have another Darth Vader, and it's just total rehash of past themes. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's not, going from the ridiculous to the sublime, let's go back to the original three, shall we?
Yeah.
Because I quite frankly, after I've seen that, I felt rather defiled and screwed up by it. And after that, I got the Blu-ray versions of the first three, and I really feel they're brilliant masterpieces. Yeah. I feel it's an enduring American legend that George Lucas has created, I believe we can use it to help understand this incredibly strange new millennium we've come into, where an event in New York of the demolition of these towers is somehow linked to the launching of a global empire.
Yes, and the explanation of something on a movie screen which isn't at all explained in front of us, in the news, as it were. Nick Nomick's put in here, he's put a Star Wars suggests to me an attempt to spin up a mythos similar to Lord of the Rings, except that the Ewoks were not as convincing as the Hobbits. I think your argument is that that Lucas was trying to do something different from what Tolkien was doing, because he's dealing with a modern myth.
Well, they're both dualistic, aren't they? Yeah. They're both dualistic, and there has to be a fight to the end, and there isn't a reconciliation. And you could say this is a weakness of a whole civilization, that we want these terrific humdingers in which the enemy gets blasted to bits. And all the energy of the film and the drama goes into some terrific edifice being built up, which then gets blasted to bits. Yeah. You know, Darth Vader dreams up, they create this whole Death Star, and the climax is it gets blown to bits. Well, at the end of it, are we any better off after it? You know, so these terrific sagas are dualistic, and obviously the male combat, but at the end of it, is anybody any better off? You know, that is a kind of weakness. If we love and if we want these big dualistic cosmic battle stories, maybe we should try and look at something like the Indian Ramayana, which is a great national epic in which people go through some process of self-discovery and learning. Mm.
Yes, indeed, something of a more balanced approach. I mean, that description that you just gave is really a fair description of how I felt when I left the Avatar movie, was that I'd just seen a kind of a dualistic scrap which had kind of rendered a bunch of people that had previously been peaceful into being kind of like, you know. But to a certain extent, it seems to me that in the movie genre, and especially in the American movie genre, that's a position you've got to take, that we don't... I'm just struggling. Here we are. Here I am, live on air. I'm just trying to think if I've ever seen a movie, a successful movie, that approaches it the other way. I mean, aren't we always dealing with dualism and blokes attacking other blokes with lightsabers?
Yeah, well, these first three episodes have... it's a very intense and vivid account of this young man, Anakin, and his guru, Qui-Gon, who realizes the enormous potency this Anakin's got and believes there's a prophecy of one who was to come who would bring balance to the Force. Okay, that's a Jedi prophecy that they all have and agree. And he believes that this young Anakin must be the one who will fulfill this prophecy, and he agrees to train him. And the Jedi Council are very doubtful because they feel that there's a lot of anger in this fellow. And Yoda says, "Much danger do I sense in this, you know, in this character." And so they don't agree to the training. And so he gets trained, then he's frustrated. They're asking him to go through this discipline of training. We'd like a bit more detail. What is the Jedi training? Which we don't really get, actually. But Senator Palpatine keeps giving a kind of siren song to young Anakin, saying, "Oh, people, they don't appreciate you. They don't trust you. They don't let you do things. You know, you follow your own intuition. You don't need guidance." You know, and urging him to use his power totally, and also continually hinting that if he goes over to the dark side, he'll have much more power, and there's no point in silly Jedi stuff. So there's a very moving account in these first three episodes of Anakin, as it were, going over to the dark side, and how it happens, and how finally, climax, he turns into Darth Vader.
Well, it sounds like a pretty accurate account as to how people do go over to the dark side to me, because, I mean, as far as I can tell, people take little steps to start with, and they more or less accidentally fall into the shadow, it's a while before the actual will takes over and takes you all of the way. I mean, I'm going to have a look at these movies, aren't I?
Yeah, well, what the hell does happen to our politicians, you know? They start off looking like normal human beings, and then something on the way up into total power, as if there's some soul replacement clinic or whatever, or something gets to them, and they end up serving the empire, and you know, the war continues, and we hardly seem to have any politician that we can trust, which I think is partly the I suggest might be why this Star Wars episode is deeply relevant to the Britain we find ourselves in. And the question is there any kind of force that can kind of rescue us from the world? We live in a world that has a weirdly powerful central authority, and we don't understand what the central authority is. I mean, where is it? You know, the Empire. We talk about the Empire. We talk about the Illuminati, and we just feel lonely, fragmented individuals. Is there some sort of force or power that can change things around at all?
Well, I'm hoping that we're going to find that out sometime in the not too distant future, but I guess we can't really tell, can we? I think it's a shame, like you say, that George sold on that franchise, because I guess it's now... I was singularly unimpressed by the last movie. I guess it's now going to go nowhere. I wonder if George has got any other projects lined up, having sold off Star Wars?
Well, no, but might be worth mentioning this first film, sci-fi film, which rather obscure, I can't remember it, but all his films are about the struggle between man and machine, okay? And this is why a very sort of Californian texture to them. Are we in a world in which machines are going to take over? Can they do everything better than what we can? And so we're continually facing that problem, or that challenge, as it were, in his films. And let me also add one other thing, Rock, that I think he's an optimist. The different worlds he creates for us are all kind of fun. They're very different qualities, different planets he brews up. And you see people having fun and enjoying them, bustling around, enjoying themselves. There are no sort of doomy, wasted characters, places where it's raining everywhere and, oh God, you know, do I have to go on living like this? He doesn't have those sort of characters, even though, you know, it's pretty awful what people are going through.
Those are my favourite scenes in the films, actually, are the bar scenes and the market scenes and the scenes where people are doing exactly what you described, the bustling about. It's one of my favourite aspects of sci-fi anyway, and I think in the first movies that were made, they were really brilliantly done. Perhaps a little bit more sketchily, well, certainly a lot more sketchily in the most recent of the films. Just before we go to a music break... One of the things that I was thinking about 9/11 was that whoever it was that pulled off the incredible going away of buildings and the even more amazing cover-up that seems to have followed it, anybody who was watching, who was in any kind of different sort of chapter or, a different, of a different political point of view or a different power base or whatever, must have looked at what went on there and thought... I mean, it must have been a really good lesson to anybody else who's in kind of world power games to dissolve a couple of buildings on your own turf. Anybody else who's kind of in competition is going to be standing back and taking a sharp intake of breath, aren't they?
Yeah, well, this is the mystery. How the hell did it happen? And who did it? And are we any nearer now, 15 years later? I mean, there is a mystery. And also, we live in a world in which kind of rational, coherent thought might be going out the window. I mean, if a large proportion of British people believe that an old man with a laptop in a cave in Afghanistan made that happen, which apparently they do, right? Majority of British people believe that. Isn't that going to, especially for youngsters growing up, isn't that going to disintegrate their capacity for, you know, coherent, rational thought? Aren't they going to be a prey to any junk they're given through the media if they believe that? Is this So I think that is sort of quite a dangerous sign, really.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that it's actually reflected in the great going away. The whole that what you're suggesting there is reflected on many levels in that, because, like I say, you look at a building doing that sort of thing and you think, well, that it's pretty obviously controlled demolition, or at least it's obvious that it didn't fall over as a building that's blown up would normally fall over. There are so many aspects of it which seem to me to be really clear and obvious, but which are still a complete mystery, and all of them on all those different levels indicate this failure to apparently just be able to look at something and reach your own conclusions, which is quite scary. It would be good if the movies help people sort some of this out. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play a bit more music, play another couple of tunes, and then hopefully Nick will come back and we'll have a quick chat about the Paul McCartney thing. And we will take it from there. Oh, I have a bit of trouble steering my mouse here. There we go. Hang on, go on, behave, will you? Technology, there we go. Here, a bit of Billy Idol and a Rebel Yell for you, and we'll be back in 5 or 6 minutes or so for a brief while, and then we'll play some more tunes. So back with you in a few moments. Billy Idol's Rebel Yell there. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com, and we're coming to you live from a field, all on open source and batteries and all that kind of stuff. Like I say, the way we like to work. We've still got Dr. Nick Collerstrom with us, because I'm hoping to just probe him a little bit on this Paul McCartney business, because it's always seemed to me to be quite clear that Paul McCartney died, in as far as all the songs he's written recently have been absolutely abysmal. But what got you even interested in it? Why did you go that way?
Well, I had hardly heard of this story, and a friend started putting it over to me. And did I realise this and did I realise that? And he gave me this book called The Memoirs of Billy Shears. He actually gave it to me to read. He wanted me to read it. And it's 666 pages and 66 chapters. And it came out on 9909. It's ostensibly an autobiography of Sir Paul, who, let's call him Fall, right? Fall, the replacement. And how he came in as a replacement, but it covers over where he came from. That's the mystery none of us can see through. We can never quite get where this guy come from. Immensely talented replacement, and he came to rescue the broken band. The Beatles were shattered. Their adorable Paul McCartney. The story is, well, this is just a story, okay, that he died in a car accident in his fast Aston Martin. Got smashed up, and then at very short notice, Brian Epstein had to get a replacement, and that is the story. And then the funny bit of the story, another funny bit, is that this happened on September the 11th, okay, 1966, the death and swift replacement, then took several months for this replacement. So he had to learn to play left-handed, and he has to start trying to get the hang of Paul McCartney. So in November, he first records, in November 66, he first records with the other three remaining Beatles. But basically it's in a studio, it's not live anymore. Suddenly the world's greatest band cannot ever, ever again perform in public, and it's just a studio thing. So ultimately you don't know what this Fall does in a studio.
Is that right? They never performed live again after 1966?
Well, they did one rooftop concert, which is far enough away from everyone that you couldn't see. Actually, you could see the replacement is a lot bigger than John Lennon. You could see that. He's got a whole lot of black hair that Paul wouldn't really have had, far bigger than John Lennon. And they're all playing separate microphones. The sort of bliss and the terrific bliss the Beatles got from singing together into the same microphone, you know, Paul and George together, or John and Paul together, that could never ever happen again. The wonderful harmony of that amazingly united, talented band singing, doing their stuff in unison, that suddenly came to an end.
And they were very noticeably a live band in those first sort of 5 or 6 years, weren't they? I mean, the films we've seen, people were mad for them.
Yeah, the whole world was in the grip of Beatlemania for 3 whole years, 63 to 66, and they were totally a live band, and really do their stuff, And Paul was the great, sort of like an English Orpheus, of as a singer.
I've still got the stream, but nobody can hear me. Let's try that. Can you still hear me out there, guys? It looks like we have a bit of a problem. And it's playing some tunes as well. Hang on a moment. There we go. There you go. I see there's been a bit of trouble in the chat box. I think it's probably kind of sorted itself out. So I'm just going to ramble on a little bit whilst I find out whether you can hear me out there. Because you see, Nick, there's a bit of a delay and stuff. So it takes a while for it to go out. But it looks like, let's just see what Tony's saying. This is always radio. Oh, there we go. Loud and clear. Yes, indeed. So, and now I've got to remember where it was we got to. We were talking about the fact that the Beatles never played live again after 1966, and they were, before that, a really, really live outfit.
So I'll just recap a bit.
Yeah.
For 3 years, the whole world was in the grip of Beatlemania, and the band was performing everywhere with ecstatic crowds listening to them. And suddenly, come September, end of August 66, they never ever sold another ticket, right? Suddenly, the world's greatest band could not ever perform again, and the adoring fans could not even be told the reason why, okay?
Wasn't there any comment about that in the press and stuff?
Well, Brian Epstein got besieged by these fans. Oh, when's the next tour going to be? When will we see the Beatles? We haven't seen them this year. You know, what's going to happen? And poor chap couldn't really say anything. And so months went by. And you started getting coy remarks. Oh, we're just going to be in a studio now. As if people say, oh, the fans, it was too noisy. They couldn't hear themselves sing. Well, a lot of bands put up with that. They don't give up. They don't wimp out just because they got terrific noise from the audience, screaming audience. Anyway, you then got this much more intellectual kind of complicated fellow taking over, with much larger head. He's a taller fellow. He's got green eyes. Paul had brown eyes. The hardest bit of taking over is to start playing left-handed on the bass guitar. And one thing we really say about him before is that he was a versatile session musician. That's one thing you do sort of gather. He was used to doing different styles. And Beatles fans were a bit shocked by this when he started playing sounding like Elvis at one point, Lady Madonna, where it didn't sound like his Liverpool accent, and a bit shocked, well, who the hell is this singing? And so it's as if he had different voice styles he could do. But as we were saying earlier, Rock, that in a studio, ultimately you don't know who's singing. We can say that Sergeant Pepper was a supreme masterpiece, and that was made right after The Replacement, okay? That's summer of 67.
Yeah.
And in a way, that they're all singing separately in those songs. They're separate songs by them. So it's a totally different, it's a work of genius, but it's very, very different from what they'd done before.
Well, presumably if there's going to be work put into pulling all of this off and then kind of covering it up, there's probably going to be quite a lot of talent available for writing the music and trying to make it as grand as possible, I would have thought.
Yeah, the idea was that the Beatles' records selling worldwide, and they were assisting the British balance of payments with the Wilson government, and that was a main reason why the show had to go on. It could not be that you could just say, oh, alas, Paul is dead, and announced in the papers. The decision was made, high-level decision, that the show must go on. Okay? Now, there's another view, which is a bit more conspiratorial, that the bumping off was deliberate. That there was some reason why they wanted to do that, whatever word reason. So my book doesn't really go into that possibility. I stick with a fairly simple, the traditional option, which is embedded in many songs. You see, the Beatles put out clues once they were in this agonising situation, losing their beloved Paul. They put out clues, and the clues gave you the story of a car crash which killed Paul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Once again, it's a pretty amazing thing to have occurred to for that to have happened and been hidden, and even after all the rumours and things like that, for it still to be kind of, it's still hidden, isn't it? I mean, most people haven't heard of it, let alone given it any thought.
Yeah, well, John Lennon, the remaining Beatles were tortured by the situation. They're putting out clues, and then in September 69 in America, the Paul is dead thing suddenly broke, and everyone said, look, there are all these clues, Paul is dead. And the Beatles were then forced to deny it. They're an agonising situation. They put out all these clues, and then John Lennon kept being asked, and he kept denying them, right? So he kept denying that anything had happened. No, of course not. And the new guy was just very, very good at affirming that he was Paul. Mind you, there are a lot of quotes from him, which are quite in my book, where he keeps saying, I feel like I'm two different people. I'm schizophrenic. Sometimes I wake up in the morning, am I really this guy? I can't believe I'm this guy, Paul McCartney. That would do my head in. So he makes a whole lot of statements kind of dismissing this, feeling as if he's two different people. He does have a new identity. It's a bit as if he's forgotten his past. That's my impression I get with Paul, that whatever happened to him, whatever he was put through to take on this new identity, he's got an uncanny memory of everything the young Paul did, right? He can generally be unfazed answering any questions about what Paul did in his youth, or in the band, what the band did where when Paul was in it. Only occasionally does he go wrong. My feeling is that he's had his own memory rather blotted out, and now for so many years he has been acting as Paul. And what he says in his book, Memoirs of Billy Shears, he says, I'm just as much Paul McCartney as the old guy. In fact, he thinks in many ways he was better. He says he could probably pass a lie detector test claiming to be Paul McCartney now.
Absolutely astonishing. Absolutely astonishing. I mean, because there's so many things that we hear about to do with mind control and retraining and the commercial aspect of the thing that you said, like they're helping out with the balance of payments and all of that. It's so much more than just a missing pop star, yeah. When once you start thinking about it.
Well, it is. I mean, let me ask you about the great albums they made after The Replacements. I mean, do you think these were better? Like, Sgt. Pepper, Abbey Road,
Double White
album, and then what was the last one?
Magical Mystery Tour.
That was a first one. That was one of the first ones they did. That was a whole video, really showcasing the new guy. And then Let It Be was awesome, wasn't it? I mean, some people don't those sell better than the original Beatles albums?
I don't know whether they did or not. I do know that there's more than a scattering of really amazing songs on all of them. My thoughts about Paul McCartney have tended to be formed around what I've heard him do after the Beatles, really, when I was listening to Mull of Kintyre and things like that, and thinking they just don't have anything like the spirit of the original McCartney songs. But then he's, working as a solo. In fact, he's done some pretty abominable songs since the Beatles split up. But I've no idea, did they sell better? What happened? I mean, Double White was pretty famous.
Yeah, it was, yeah. I mean, given my personal opinion, I don't actually like any of the music that McCartney puts out after the Beatles broke up. Okay, I wouldn't want to listen to it. I mean, I got the albums called Ram and McCartney that he made immediately after, with Linda Eastman. Those two put out some albums immediately after, and you hear this voice that isn't terribly musical. It doesn't sound particularly attractive. The words are rather crummy. I feel that the reason why you get 100,000 people turn up to a Paul McCartney concert is because they think it's the old Paul McCartney. They think they're getting a terrific blast of memory lane. Isn't it amazing? Well, no, it isn't actually the same guy. He's got quite a sort of, apparently, obviously in his 70s, we should appreciate and marvel that anyone can do that at all in that age. Yeah. I feel that the attraction people have for his albums comes somewhat because they believe it's the Old Paul. Yeah. But I've got, I know people, real music experts, who disagree with me here. They say he's done some brilliant albums on this and that, which, but it doesn't personally attract me at all.
Just strikes me as being a manager just completely different, you know, really, really very seriously pedestrian, actually, and very difficult to listen to.
Yeah, I mean, the one real genius for me after Beatles broke up was George Harrison. You listen to his albums, you know, wonderful musician. John Lennon and Yoko is I think he's in a bad way, very bad way with Yoko, and I have quite a lot of negative comments about Yoko. What she did to him. But by the way, we might notice that both Yoko Ono and Linda Eastman went to the same college in New York, and then they both sort of got onto a Beatle and married them. And they both got into the band, and neither of them had any musical talent at all. So there is a bit of a similarity there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's another thing, isn't it? The fact that, you know, the wives must have known that it wasn't the real Paul McCartney and stuff, and it just makes you wonder how far these things can be pushed. What's your book called, for a start off? What's it...
The Life and Death of Paul McCartney, 1942-66.
I should be having a copy of that away myself. And what about the comments that Ringo Starr is purported to have made recently, confessing to the whole plot?
Well, that was in the Hollywood Inquirer, which is a strictly fictional newspaper, I don't know why it's got so much coverage. And what he did say, very very weighty statement, I think 2011, he said, "I am the last remaining Beatle." And he said that twice, very emphatically. And Paul was with him at the time. He said, "Look, us two, we've been through loads of history together. You know, we've seen it all together." And then after that, he said, very thoughtfully, "I am the last remaining Beatle." And he has to be very careful what he says. Ringo doesn't say much, okay? And he has stayed alive. Both Lennon and George were attacked by total maniacs, neither of whom seemed to know why they attacked a Beatle, or why they needed to do it. And both lived in deep fear of just that attack happening for years before it did happen, okay?
Yeah. Interestingly enough, that brings us to a question that Unique Lee's just put in the chat box. He's put a term as a kind of segue, or is there anyone else that you consider has been body snatched out of today's world, which again is a question that's occurred to me. Is it happening all the bloody time?
Well, my last chapter does focus. If you think of the big chocolate brown eyes of Paul, and the green, and then this guy in the 21st century has got different blue eyes. I suggest that the same thing happened to Bob Dylan. Look at the early Bob, and he had brown eyes, and he's got very blue eyed. And then for a long time he had glasses on, dark glasses. You couldn't see his eyes. And I quote from his long interview he gave to Rolling Stone about how he'd been replaced, and claiming that he'd been transmogrified, or what's the word, he'd been replaced and changed. He said, "I'd love to meet the old Bob Dylan if I could, but I can't. He's gone. I'd like to reach out a hand and shake his hand, but I can't. He's gone forever." And he did make very explicit statements. So I wonder if this does happen. There's a Scorsese film about Bob Dylan, which ends in 66, right? And that might be a good time for his film to end. And Dylan's rolling some bit of heroin or something, and he says, "I'm going to get me a new Bob Dylan. I'm going to get me a new Bob Dylan, see how long he lasts." So that might be a replay. Some people believe there have been several Bob Dylans, and people who... known, admired Dylan for many years, say at his last concerts, you know, he's not there. Bob Dylan just is not there at these concerts. You know, if I may quote from one line from one of his songs, "I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form." It may be that there is some replacement by psychological operations we don't really know about.
Blimey, well, that's a bit distressing, isn't it? Not just Paul McCartney, but Bob Dylan as well. Where does it all end? That's the question. Well, that was really enlightening, thank you very much, because it's the first chance I've had a chance to actually talk to anybody about this, but I'll have your book away and read that as well. And Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure. Yeah, pleasure. Yeah.
You're going to be writing about the Star Wars and the 9/11, or is that just a talk?
Definitely not. No, that's a very visual thing. It's just a talk, yeah.
Right. Brilliant. Well, so I can look forward to seeing Nick Collerstrom tomorrow morning. We're hoping to do another show on Saturday night when hopefully more of our presenters and guests will have turned up, and I'll have, because I only arrived here today. I normally arrive a couple of days before the show. I haven't had really time to get things together. So there'll be more on Saturday night. In the meantime, I'm going to play a bit of music. I'll probably be back with you before the end of the show at 11 o'clock, and I go to examine what's in the bar. They seem to have lots of barrels of beer at least, so good place for me to go. In the meantime, thanks very much to Nick Collerstrom and to Sarah. I'll be back with you in a few minutes, and I am going to play a Beatles song, but I'm going to play it by the Georgia Satellites. It's called Don't Pass Me By. It was on the Double White album, and don't be fooled by the low volume levels at the beginning. Think it was one of his. Yeah, indeed.
Really good line about you're in a car crash and you lost your hair.
You were in a car crash and you lost your hair. Yeah, that's one. Yeah, it is a Ringo Starr song, and it was one of his really good ones, I think.
The main love of his life. He says, yeah, in this song, he says, Paul was the main love of his life, and don't you leave me. You can't believe he's not with him any longer. And who is this main love of his life he's singing about? And then at the last verse, he says, you were in a car crash and you lost your hair. So it's really Ringo's song about Paul.
Very good. Perfectly chosen by the DJ there, and on blind intuition, apparently. Back with you in 7 or 8 minutes or so. That was The Jam, of course, and In the City. And before that, Neat, Neat, Neat by The Damned. So I remember hearing first on the John Peel radio show many years ago. And just so totally thinking, oh, well, that's new and exciting, isn't it? I must admit, I don't hear too much stuff like that nowadays. So here I am, Synchro's napping over there. There's a band on the stage, and there's not too many guests around. Mark Windows was going to be with us tonight, but one way or the other, that turned out not to be possible, so we're hoping to engineer him into the place tomorrow, and perhaps he'll be with us for a show on Saturday night. A bit more news on what else might be on Saturday night in a few minutes. In the meantime, let's have some slide guitar, shall we? George Thorogood and the Destroyers, Ladies and Gentlemen, Madison Blues. Fun-loving criminals and smoke 'em if you've got 'em. I was just taking their sound advice there whilst that was going on. And we've come to just about the end of another Dr. Rock radio show on raconteursnews.com. We should be, as I say, back with you on Saturday night between 9 and 11 for a bonus live show from the field. And I expect to be joined then by a band called Mobius Loop, who were playing when our show started on Saturday night in the Conscious Tribal Gathering. They also make the most amazing hemp hot chocolate and hemp smoothies, and run a most fascinating store called Hemp Redemption. So they're going to be coming on and chatting with me, and we'll be playing some of their tunes as well. I'm hoping to be able to get Adrian Gilbert along, because he's coming to talk in the Pentos Talk space. And I gather that Darren Diogi, my old mate, is going to be here, although he's calling himself Christopher nowadays. So I reckon the Saturday night show is probably going to be a real cracker, as long as we're all still upright and walking. As I say, coming to the end of another one, 5 minutes or so to go, so why don't we see the way out with some Deep Purple? It ain't Saturday night, I haven't just got paid, but I do feel like I have, and I don't need the speed anymore either. I'm off to the bar to catch up with Nick and to watch a band or so, and who knows, maybe score the occasional CD, and I'll be back with you on Saturday night. In the meantime, ta to all of you for being there. I'll see you soon. Bye.